most important, you need to have a good relationship with the lender and you need to understand what they can and cannot do.
My name is Patrick Hübscher and this is Circularity FM, the podcast about understanding, building and managing circular business models.
Welcome to the 8th episode of PaaS Decoded, 16 conversations about the fine details of product as a service. In the last episode, Ankita Das introduced us to rebound effects and mitigation strategies. In today's episode, we learn more about how to leverage debt to finance product as a service assets. He studied economics, worked for the Royal Bank of Scotland, and was corporate finance lead at Creditech. He worked for over 5 years for Grover. His last position was Senior Vice President Finance and Head of Debt Capital Markets. Currently, he is CFO and co-founder of Squall. He has a track record of successfully raising over $1.6 billion in debt financing and over $190 million in equity financing for various companies. Welcome, Mitya.
Hello, glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Mitya, you don't speak on behalf of Grover anymore, but may I still ask, what is your favorite product at Grover?
That's actually a good question in a sense that on one end, if I want something long term, I mean, of course, I like to get a new iPhone. And I also like actually the home appliances section in the sense that if I want a nice Roomba or Hoover for a couple of months, that's something I got as well.
Okay, cool. So during your time, how was Grover's asset finance structured?
So when I started, there was a small facility with Varga Bank. I think that's public info, so I think we can disclose that. And it was, in a way, measuring the value of the assets, mark to market. So you went to a certain agreed secondary players, requested the price for those, and that's how it was structured, was valued. And we have built on that as the Grower expanded, brought together a couple of very strong players. And yeah, every year was a new height in terms of what we had, both in terms of the assets as well as in terms of the structure. We were moving it towards more grown-up structure, preparing for the capital markets. Obviously, then came the 2022 and a little bit change in the whole outlook for the whole startup ecosystem as a whole, where then we slowed down a little bit the expectations with regards to the public markets, and we haven't pursued that option since then. And then, yeah, afterwards when I left, I don't have information in the sense of what's been developing.
Okay. When you talk about the structure, what do you mean by that? So different legal entities and contracts, or what do you refer to there?
Yes. So what you generally have in a securitization structure or in an asset-backed structure is that you have a financier or a lender who is comfortable with the risk of the underlying, so of the risk of the asset and the customer receivables, but not necessarily with the risk of a startup itself and the operational things that you have in a classical startup. So what typically happens is that you create a special entity or a special purpose vehicle, to use the correct name, the SPV, where you put in all the assets that you plan to finance this way, and the assets refer to both physical assets or any customer receivables or whatever is the object that's being financed by the lender. And in that way, and you grant security to the lender with that regard. So what you have effectively done is you have separated the risk of the startup as a new operating growing entity, which the lender did not feel comfortable with, and the assets themselves and the portfolio that the lender is financing with which they feel comfortable. And in that way, you can obtain funding for this portfolio at a way that's much cheaper than if you wouldn't separate it. And that's the reason why securitization has been proliferating quite a lot. And I mean, it's also the product that it's not only used by startups. I think one of the biggest originators in Germany is Volkswagen, mm-hmm. which is securitizing consumer leases, so the car leasing. So it's a very well-established product, well-received by the investors. And funnily enough, that was pretty much the only product issued by Volkswagen during the Dieselgate scandal that did not have a massive repricing as a result, because the investors understood that the risk is on the customers and on the vehicles, not on the Volkswagen as a group and any fines that they will get as a result.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So actually you separate like the customer facing company, legal entity, and then the special purpose vehicle that owns the asset and gets the funding from one or several lenders.
Correct. And the only thing what's connecting them is, of course, that customers then need to pay to that entity and not to the customer facing.
Okay.
But yes.
Okay. Clear. And not sure if you can disclose that, but the ownership of the special purpose vehicle is completely by the customer, usually completely by the customer facing company or startup.
That depends, but generally, yes. I mean, there's no obligation why you cannot put this on the stock market. I mean, if you want to. And you have, for example, certain real estate investment trusts are there, and shipping companies, they actually usually sold the ownership to the pension funds in Germany. So the whole topics. So you can always, you're not obliged to own it 100%, but with the startups, it's generally the case that they do own a significant majority, if not 100% of those.
Okay, clear. You mentioned that initially the main partner was Vanguard Bank, and later on there more lenders appeared. If I start a renting model, which funding stages can I expect later on?
Yeah. So what you have is, in the first level, you are proving the concept. So this is the financing which you generally do with equity to make sure that you can originate and that the customers pay and that the customers accept. So this is normally small volumes, up to a couple hundred thousand, just to build some initial traction, initial track record, and show it. After you have done that, you normally go towards the early stage investors, such as Vanguard Bank, for example, which will give you a facility of up to a couple of million. I think Grover started with a 4 million facility with the ability to draw in 100,000 tranches. And that basically means that as you buy more assets, you can actually, you know, scale and grow. But at the same time, this is small and flexible enough that, you know, it doesn't overwhelm you. Because the problem is, once you go to the next level, where you get larger facilities, up to 20 million, you normally have 500,000 to 1 million minimum drawdown. That means that if you are originating 30, 40, 50,000 per month and you need to draw 1 million, the cost of that is going to kill you, financially speaking, just because you're going to have a lot of money sitting on your bank account for which you're actually paying interest. Mm-hmm. And that's why you need to go first with the early stage, somebody like a bank that I mentioned, that can do smaller attractions. And then as you grow, as you expand, you will see that there's a relatively big gap on the market between 25 and 100 million or 25 and a 75 million facility. So what we have done in Grover at that point in time was to bring a second party on board with about the same size that the Vargo Bank did. Mm-hmm. And that's how we reached 35, 40 million total, let's say, total capacity. And from then, we were able to make a jump to a larger area. And when we got Fasanara on board, I think that was also publicly disclosed, we were able to significantly increase the facilities and expand. And at some point, when you see that you have a lot of dependency and a lot of utilization, you want to bring a second party on board, just in a sense of not having all the eggs in one basket. And that's what we have also done with the M&G, which is a big British-based or UK-based fund that was a stepping stone towards the transaction that I mentioned, which was in the works, that would have been a public transaction, which obviously, because of the changes in 22, didn't happen.
Okay, clear. What makes it so difficult to find partners between 20 and 75 or 100 million?
Because this is exactly the science where partners already expect that you have certain structures in place, certain maturity as a company, mm-hmm. and you're still too small to actually have it. So what can result in that, and that's the experience we also had, is that if you try to grow too quickly before you're ready for it, I mean, to get the facility from a too big partner, you end up doing 9 months due diligence, the result of which is you need to still do this and this and this before you're ready. And that's, on one hand, not only that it's demotivating, it's super distracting. And you're better off doing it step by step and in a proper sequence to make sure that you have the maturity. It should always be a stretch, the facility that you're raising, because it should always bring you to the next level as a corporate maturity. But you cannot skip 3-4 steps because that just doesn't work operationally.
Okay. And by structures, you mean things like credit check, risk management, the financial operations to actually be able to handle this amount of money.
Risk management, exactly. So risk management, internal controls, the maturity to handle complexity. So for example, if you go from a deal where you're dealing with a bank, you make one transfer per month to a party which uses 17 funds or 20 funds on their end to finance you, you suddenly have to make 20 different interest payments every month when you get different payment instructions. That's an operational complexity that your treasury needs to learn how to deal with it, how to do it. And to top it off, normally at the size when you raise your first facility, you don't have a treasury team. So it's difficult to handle that. You have certain audit requirements, you have certain reporting requirements, you have certain data analysis complexity that you need to do. It's all doable, don't get me wrong. It adds a certain layer of cost, which you should not necessarily carry at the too low level or too small size of the company.
So for most founders starting off, especially the initial phase is interesting, or also the second phase when you mentioned you had the partner like Vernon Gold, where to find these kind of partners?
Yeah. So for the first phase, it should normally be friends and family or the early stage investors, but already try to structure it properly, because everybody wants to see track record. And if you don't structure it properly, you will not have this track record to show. So that's why it's good to get to work with a strong legal company, legal firm from the beginning, with the good lawyers who can help you, guide you to set it up in a way that from the day one, you're building the track record. And then how do you find the second stage? So the investors who will then bring you to the first couple million. It's on one hand, lawyers are a good source of referrals. They see who's doing deals in the market. Also listening to or looking at what other people in the space have gotten or who they have gotten facilities from. So there's an announcement, hey, Vanguard Bank did this deal. Eiffel Capital, for example, did that deal, whatever. And then you can reach out to those. And investors can sometimes also be helpful in saying, hey, you could try this one as well. But at the end of the day, who you need to find is somebody who is willing to invest the work to understand what you're doing. Because unless you're doing a classical copycat, in most of the cases, your product doesn't exist on the market, which means that somebody needs to be willing to put in the work to understand what are the risks, what are the benefits, and how to secure themselves. And then you can structure the proper deal. I mean, at this level, getting an advisor, it's something I would not recommend, because advisors are very good at the classical plain vanilla deal, print, repeat, print, rinse, repeat. But when you have a bespoke deal where you need to figure out together with the lender how to make them secure, but how to still make them be able to do the deal that works both for you operationally as well as financially, you need to have a relationship directly with the lender. You need to build it. You cannot rely on a third party to do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, makes sense. You mentioned
there's another reason for that. Sorry to interrupt. And that is, at this stage, you're likely going to pivot or tweak or whatever you want to call the product at least 2, 3, 4 times. And that's why you need somebody flexible who understands it, who will be able to accommodate that pivot. But that's also the reason why you don't go with the big ones immediately, because the big ones, because of the nature and because of the amount of money that they go through, they cannot be too flexible. They try to accommodate, and they are super, super reasonable. So I have very good experience with the big ones as well. But if you need to do a major pivot, that's something that they cannot go along.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You mentioned that you have to show track record early on. What are key metrics that you need to prove in order to show that track record?
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, regardless of what you're doing, lender is giving you the money. They need to see the return on the money and return of the money, basically, in short. So they need to see that there are sufficient cash flows generated to pay the interest, etc., and that they have a relative strong visibility of recovering their money in case things go well, which obviously everybody, that's super easy to show. And in case things don't go well, which is, of course, more difficult to show. But in both sides, lenders need to be satisfied, reasonably satisfied that they will be able to recover the money. Because what the lenders like to say is, there's only one thing more important than return on money, and that's return of money. And they don't want default, yeah, because default for them is much more expensive. Equity is a bit more open to risk because equity has an unlimited upside if you do well. The debt has, in the best case scenario, the interest. In the worst case scenario, they need to take a haircut.
Okay. You also referred to getting professional lawyers on board rather early. Can they also help in avoiding any mistakes later on, or what's important to watch out for in structuring these contracts?
Yeah, so that's a very good question, I think. In terms of the lawyers can make sure that they structure a deal that makes sense and that's flexible enough, and that enables you to do the things that you need to do. But I mean, what's super important is actually your relationship with the lender, because contract with a big organization is set in stone. With a small lender, with a smaller player, you adapt it on the relationship. And then if you pivot, you cannot foresee all future events in a contract. So that's very important, is that you work with a lender that where you have a strong enough relationship to be able to amend the things as the need arises, as it changes. That doesn't mean that you go around and say, okay, now we take the interest out of the contracts and I'm not paying any interest. Obviously, I mean, it doesn't work that way. But I mean, if you agree that 80% of your assets will be in Germany, and then you suddenly have an amazing opportunity to launch France, and you need to adapt the contract to say, okay, we can have up to 40% of assets in France and we can use the same facility. That's something that a smaller lender will be able to adjust relatively quickly, provided that, of course, you can show that the risk return rewards in France are similar to the Germany. But it's something that a bigger player might struggle with, because they invested from a fund that's focused on Germany, and that fund might have prohibition from investing in France, because there's another fund for France and things like that. So most important, you need to have a good relationship with the lender and you need to understand what they can and cannot do. And if you have a good discussion, you will know that relatively quickly. I mean, they will tell you, look, I mean, this is something we can do. This is something we can't do. And then you know, and I say, okay, fine, we want to do this, but we cannot do this with this lender. So we need to find another lender who can cover that. Or this change is not allowed in the contract, but I know that the lenders are happy to do that. If, of course, they're appropriately, risk is appropriately protected and they're properly compensated for that, then you go and you talk with the lenders and you adjust the contract to make sure that you can do that. And that's why relationship is super important.
And next to relationship, are there mistakes you can make in your early agreements that you will regret later on when you grow to further stages and have more partners?
Of course. Of course, there are, and this is something that you can do both on the debt or the equity side, and that means that any terms that you agree on tend to be carried from one contract to the other. So whatever concession you made on day zero is likely going to happen in the next 1, 2, 3 facility, until you come to the level where it's a paradigm change, where you have a power to take those clauses out. So on the equity side, These terms normally carry all the way until IPO, and at IPO you have a chance to do a clean reset of the terms, and on the debt side as well, until you reach 200, 300 million facility, that's where you have a chance to wipe the slate clean and remove any of the other terms. But even then, you will, like on the debt side, have a bit more pushback, in a sense that if you have done things in one particular way, and now you want to change it in a way that's less favorable to lenders, unless you have a very strong interest and a lot of competition on the product, it will be very tough to get those clauses even at that side out.
So everyone should get experts in rather early on.
I mean, you need to understand that any concessions you do, you're likely to have them on forever. So you should not do a concession, let's get this deal on the road and we're going to get it done, get it out in the next one or two deals. You're going to likely live with them for the foreseeable future. Rated deal or a bond are, of course, the differences. So if you work towards a bond or a rated deal, then you're fine to accept on the private side a bit more painful stuff, because once you do a rated deal, there's a market standard and you will need to comply with that market standard anyway. And there's not going to be a push to deviation in one way or the other. So on that side, you're fine if you're working towards that takeout. But if you want to stay on the private side, you will be carrying those terms for some time.
Okay. You mentioned initially that there's return on money and return off money. So, of course, also first one is a bit like the interest rates. Can you give a short overview? When do lenders get the return on money and the return off money?
Yeah. So return on money is the interest payment, and return off money is when you pay them back the principal. Mm-hmm. So that's effectively it. Normally, for lenders, the return off money, it's very important. And that's normally non-negotiable, because they cannot earn in interest that much that they can lose in the principal if they cannot recover the principal. So lenders are, let's say, they put the negative glasses on when they evaluate the deal, and they need to be comfortable that even in a negative scenario, things are fine and everything works. Or at least it works to a degree that they have a reasonable path to recover their principal. That's the key message. And then return on money, it's of course the yield that they're targeting for their portfolio, for their funds, and is there. But the reason why they are in this sense is that you need to have, imagine you have a yield of 10%. In a year, if you have 10 deals that are all equal in size, and one deal collapses, and everybody else pays you the 10% interest, you will still be 10% down. So that means, but if you have if everybody pays you 5% and you make sure that every deal returns you the money, you will be 5% up. So for them, the return of money and the security is much more important than yield, and it's generally a bit more difficult to let them relax on the structure for an extra yield or two, extra percentage point or two. Sometimes they do it. Some lenders are more open to take a bit more risk in exchange for higher return. But generally, most of the lenders, especially the ones who don't get any equity upside, any warrants, will want to make sure that their downside is protected before they even start thinking about the upside.
Mm-hmm. And are these deals usually, do they come with a fixed date when the lenders do get the full money back? Or is it a bit like ongoing and open, or do both versions exist?
Well, it's actually both at the same time. So they have a final maturity date, but the expectations that they will either be rolled over or refinanced.
Well, can you elaborate more on these two options then?
Yeah, so you negotiate a deal where you say, okay, I have 2 or 3 years to take the money, and then I have another 2 years to pay it back, pretty much. And that's pretty much standard structure, so that you have either 2+1, 2+2, 2+3, or 3+2, something like that you normally see. And then what you normally have an expectation is that as the end of the so-called revolving period, so the first period in which you can take the money, is coming to an end, that you will either agree a new transaction with the same lender, or you will bring a new lender and repay or refinance the existing facility. Which means that lender will get the money back under that original loan, and then either issue a new loan or somebody else will issue a loan. But you as a company have almost an evergreen facility. And you just need to make sure that you don't have any significant deterioration in the performance metrics, because obviously if your underlying is not performing as it should, you won't be able to get it refinanced. But as long as everything runs well, this is for a company an evergreen facility that stays in place and is just either increased, refinanced, or extended.
Mm-hmm. And referring to the underlying, does the structure of the funding affect the, let's say, the operations in or the growth? I mean, you can imagine, especially in the early phase, it can limit your growth if you don't have funds anymore to grow. Yeah. But can it also be the other way around?
It should not, in a sense that if you do things properly, a customer wouldn't even notice that you're refinancing that on somewhere else. So a customer will be doing business with you as a customer-facing entity, and then you will be operating things just normally and refinancing in the end. Sometimes the customers will, of course, see that you're using a refinancing partner, but I mean, that's not an issue. So no, it should not impact your growth. And generally, if you see that you are changing your strategy to comply with the financing requirements, you messed up on structuring the deal, because it should not. You need to do what's best for the company, and financing structure is there to support your growth, your plan to deliver. The moment this is no longer the case, you need to refinance or renegotiate the transaction with the lender to make sure that it does not limit the business. It is there to support the business.
Mm-hmm. Stick to the underlying, or let's say the product portfolio. Are some products more attractive assets for lenders than others?
That's like objectively, no. So objectively, the lenders are saying, look, you're an asset manager. You do an asset allocation and you get me a certain cash yield with a proper structure in place. So that means backup servicers. I don't actually care if you have bicycles, phones, computers, or cars. At the end of the day, I give you money, I get money back, and I get my return in money. So whatever you do in terms of the assets, I don't really care. That's on a purely objective and rational side. However, people are not always fully rational, and certain people prefer cars, certain people prefer iPhones, to, or like, you know, there are certain things which subjectively the credit team might feel they're more like more better, and with certain products you have easier way of getting them approved. For example, just a typical case, if you come up with a solar panel or a windmill, the electrical mills for electricity, it's easier to get them placed and structured than if you come up with the idea of, I don't know, refinancing computers or providing robots for factories. Part of it, obviously, objectively, because you have a lot of support on the ESG side and on the renewables. Part of it because, let's say, if you have a specialized robot in the factory, it's a bit more difficult to dismantle and, in a negative scenario, a bit more costly to turn it into cash. But ultimately, if they all produce the same cash flows, you should be broadly agnostic to that, unless you have something else written in your investment principles.
Yes.
Which could be like only invest in renewable energy or don't invest in specific sectors or stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. And have you seen limitations in a way that the asset doesn't have a second market yet? So it's pretty difficult to determine the value of the asset after 1 or 2 years being used?
So that's not only the financial problem, that's also the commercial problem of the company. And how you answer this on the commercial operating level will also drive the financing. I mean, if you say, look, I mean, I'm renting it out, I have no clue how to get rid of the asset, then you haven't figured out your unit economics yet. And then, I mean, this is not a financeable product. However, if you have a clear plan and you say, look, I mean, I'm renting this out to customers or I'm leasing this out to customers, whatever, for 3 years or 2 years, and afterwards I recycle it and we still make good money out of it, then this is what the lender will underwrite.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you just need to, I mean, you need to have on a commercial level a plan. Finance, like I said, the financial structure should not be driving the business. It should follow the business and implement the business in a way that makes sense and just make sure that there's money there to execute the things that business or that you decided on the commercial side.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And is there also some interaction on the maturity? So if there are some people who prefer a Hoover at home, and then you also have the asset like a robot in a factory. So something, the first one might be 6 months, the other one might be 6 years. How does it influence the debt financing structure?
It changes the ratio between the value of the receivable and the value of the asset. And it changes a little bit how you structure it. But ultimately, it gives you a depreciation rate that you need to pay one way or the other. And it gives you certain cash flows that you need to distribute one way or the other. So at the core, it does not change it. It does change the proportions a little bit and how quickly you need to originate new deals to keep the same lending volume or the same volume of the borrowings. So for example, if you have a Hoover that you throw away after 6 months just because it breaks, that of course the cost of depreciation and the need to replace it is much higher than with a robot that you install and you keep it for 10 years running in a factory, etc. You of course have also very different topics in terms of maintenance. So the robot needs much more maintenance and regular maintenance and checks, and the maintenance book becomes much more relevant for the lending and for the lender than it does on a Roomba, which in any case it's planned to be discarded after whatever time has been rented. It's basically changes a couple of the details, but ultimately you need to prove to the lender that you're getting in more cash than the product is losing in terms of the value, and that more cash is sufficient to cover their downside and to cover the interest costs and your operating expense.
And the last question on, let's say, product diversity and portfolio is also related to risk. So if we take Grover serves multiple categories, be it consumer electronics, but also office equipment, home appliances, and many subscriptions focus on one niche, yeah, be it bicycles, be it just certain type of furniture. Is this problematic on the lender side in terms of risk and diversification, or is it rather common that you didn't just have a partner who is willing to take that, let's say, industry risk or segment risk?
I think that's a decision for each lender in terms of how much diversification versus concentrations they want to have. I don't see this as a problem per se, as long as you can show sufficient resilience to any external shocks. So, I mean, if you would be saying, I only do iPhone 15, and or let's put it a bit more case, if you do Huawei and you only focus on Huawei, and then Huawei gets banned in European Union for whatever reason, obviously that's a concentration that you as a company should not be taking unless you decided this is how it works. But generally, if you have a healthy mix of products and brands, or depending on, you know, it depends on which industry you're in, you need to demonstrate that from the commercial side, it makes sense. And that final side will follow. Lenders might have an objection, but quite frankly, if you're surprised and for the first time hear that objection from the lender and not from your commercial team, you need to have a chat with your commercial team first. And by then, after you have had a chat, you either have an answer or you fire all of them and talk to them to manage the thing properly. But in any case, jokes aside, what's super important, again, here, the lenders will ask questions that they believe, but those questions should not surprise you, and you should have been asking those questions yourself. Am I comfortable with this concentration? Am I comfortable of by buying 100% of my products from China, knowing what's happening geopolitically? If the answer to this is yes, and I have a good reason why, that's the reason I'm going to sell to the lender as well, and the lender will most likely accept it if the reason is real and not like a fake, just, yeah, we're just doing that, but we want to do that. But if it's a real, well-reasoned reason, it's fine.
Okay, cool.
But in this case, I mean, the lender wants to make sure that the risk position is secured. And as long as you can give them reasonable comfort, it's fine. If you can't, then you should have a problem on the commercial side anyway, which you need to address as well. And that should be addressed first.
I like your simple and clear answers. Mitya, I have three last more generic questions. So the first one is, what's the main thing you need to make sure as a brand or manufacturer before you start a circular product as a service?
Well, that's a good one. I mean, I think you need to understand how the circularity works for your product. How do your customers use it? And why would a circularity or a circular system work for your customers? So for example, if you do cars, how does the car ownership cycle works? So first, you sell a new car to somebody who uses it for 2-3 years or 4 years, sells it on, somebody buys the newly used car or like, you know, relatively new used and uses it for another 4, 5, 6 years. And then somebody buys a 10-year-old clunker, uses it for another 5, 10 years, and then the car gets bust, whatever the cycle is. I mean, then what you need to see is, okay, how can I actually add value to the whole thing? I mean, am I doing circularity just for the purpose of showing it on an ESG report and not thinking about it? That's, from my perspective, the wrong way to do it, but sometimes it's telling. But if you really think, okay, as a car owner or as a car manufacturer, how can I disrupt really that sector? What can I offer that's going to make the life of people easier? And in the car, for example, you already have leasing for 3-4 years. That takes care of, or at least in the eyes of many people, takes care of the first problem. You don't have any proper solution for leasing other than financing or down the line. You don't have a good solution, or you didn't have a good solution for, let's say, a flexible leasing. I mean, with the leasing, you sign a 3-year contract, you move out of the country after 18 months, you better pay off the whole leasing. There's no way you can get out of it. I mean, it's not a flexible contract. So if you want to do as a car OEM, you might want to think about, you know, offering a flexible option to get out of it. But for the car specifically, what's the problem after the car is used? Nobody knows the provenance. Nobody knows the servicing. Nobody can do this thing. So if you can solve as part of your product, circular product, the problems down the line, which are currently not being addressed, or it's currently a little bit shady market where you don't know if your car has been properly serviced, if you still have the original parts in, etc., if the manufacturer can, after the end of the lease period, take back this product and again offer a flexible solution for the people who are down market for this product, but at the same time validate everything well, that works. So basically, before you offer a circular product, understand how your market and understand where do you actually add value and where are you uniquely positioned to add a lot of value. But at the same time, obviously, you don't want to be peddling 10-year-old cars. So you also have to make sure that it doesn't dilute your brand.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Second question. What are significant trends you see in circular renting or renting in general for the next 5 years?
I think just mostly continuation of the previous trends. I mean, what you have there is, in general, especially in Europe, people getting more and more comfortable with the utilization or use versus ownership. So this is going to be continuing trend that's going to be happening. people getting more and more concerned about end of life and how to make sure that what I'm doing is sustainable. That's specifically a German topic, but also slowly spreading in Europe. What's my CO2 footprint? And that's something that you need to address as part of your circular offering, because I wouldn't say it's important for everybody, but probably for 10 to 20% of your users, once you're at scale, this is important. I mean, when you're small, I mean, this is the niche you target first, or you can target first, but after you scale, probably 10 to 20% of your population will be the one for whom that really matters. And you will also have the trend towards, I don't need leverage, I don't want to have financing, I want to have a flexible solution, because my life is changing. And we're seeing in general that we're starting to live faster and faster, and that we tend to be less stuck in a geographical situation than we were in the past. People are moving around.
True. Yeah. And my last question is about sharing knowledge, connecting people. Maybe you have some milestones you want to reach, opportunities to unlock. If someone is listening to this conversation right now, who should get in contact with you?
Well, that's a good question, actually. I mean, there's on a professional level, I am right now breaching out into the board advisory and positions where I can help younger companies, startups with an interesting concept in, let's say, in an asset heavy areas where my expertise can be deployed and where I can help them, at least guide them. Because in most of those cases, the companies don't need somebody like me full time. They can't afford somebody like me full time. But having somebody like that on the board where you can ask a question or two on a structure every now and then can help you avoid some mistakes, can help you get there. So that's one of the options where we can do. On the other side, right now, as you mentioned at the beginning, I'm a co-founder of Scroll. And at Scroll, we're right now looking to actually unlock the potential of the small and medium-sized companies by acquiring them and then preparing them for growth and for scaling. So anybody who's interested in that area, super happy to connect and exchange ideas. And yeah, I mean, if there are investors who want to invest in that area or people who want to work there, let's have a chat. Let's see if there's enough of common ground that we do something together.
Nice. So dear listeners, I'll add the link to Mitya in our show notes. Reach out to him. And Mitya, thanks again for sharing your experience, answering this question and giving us insight into structuring the debt financing.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This was another episode of PaaS Decoded, 16 conversations about the fine details of product as a service. If you liked it, share this episode with colleagues or on social media. If you missed a question or topic, please send me an email so I can improve the conversations for you. If you learned something from this episode, please provide a review via Spotify or Apple Podcasts. That helps others to discover the podcast. And don't forget, the most abundant renewable resource is your imagination.
My name is Patrick Hübscher, and this is Circularity FM, the podcast about understanding, building, and managing circular business models.